Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Metal Hammer Podcast, episode 148. I am Mo, and if I'm sounding a little bit tinny and weird today, it's because I forgot to set my mic up properly, like an absolute idiot. So sorry about that. Luckily, I am saved by the experts, the professionals that are Jonathan Seltzer, reviews editor at Metal Hammer. How are you doing, Seltz?
I'm doing pretty good. Hello, and hopefully sounding a lot clearer than you.
Yes, you certainly are. Also joined by the one and only Miss Eleanor Goodman, Deputy Editor of Metal Hammer. How's it going, Al?
I'm all right, thanks. The sun has just come out, and now I just want to go and get a big ice cream.
It has. It's looking glorious over at...
Yeah, that's the thing about English people, or British people. Just the minute it hits like 12 or 13 degrees, everyone suddenly thinks, for the first time in the year, everyone suddenly thinks it's like the French Riviera all of a sudden.
Jonathan, I will eat ice cream in the snow.
Whoa. Actually, so wow.
It's pretty good. We're also recording on a new system today, so I'm just testing out some little bits as we go along, but hopefully it all sounds swell. There's a lot to talk about this week, but before we get stuck into all of that, there is still the latest issue of Metal Hammer that is out right now as we speak. You've got about one more week here in the UK to pick up our January issue, starring the four awesome young bands that we've put on the cover this month. Twin Temple, The Who, Heilung and Alien Weaponry, four of the most exciting young bands in the scene today. Each have their own cover. You can go out and pick your favourite in the shops across the UK right now. We also have some bundles on sale at the moment. We've got a Who bundle featuring an exclusive cover and a Who face mask. We've literally only got, I think it's in the low tens of those bundles left now. We've also got an Alien Weaponry bundle where you can also get an exclusive cover alongside a very cool Maori-themed keychain. It's a pendant, sorry. Cool little necklace thingy that you can get with that as well. And the Heilung bundle might just be one of my favourites we've done, as well as the exclusive Heilung cover. It also comes with a Heilung colouring book, because what's more metal than colouring in? You can get all of those right now from Magazines Direct or tinyurl.com/gethammer. We did have Twin Temple bundles on sale, but they sold out very quickly, and these ones may well do the same. So if you like the sound of those, make sure you get on those ASAP. Right, lots of news to get through this week. System of a Down are doing a live stream, which sounded very exciting until we found out that it might not actually be a performance. Have I got that right, Jonathan?
So I've been told it's a panel stroke discussion. I'm sure it'll still be fascinating anyway. But yeah, damn about that.
How can we watch it? Tell us.
Are you asking me?
Anyone?
Well, I think it's on YouTube, isn't it?
Yeah, from 5 PM UK time on Saturday, January the 30th.
Yes. Tune in via YouTube. 5 PM UK time, as Jonathan said, this Saturday, Jan 30th. There's going to be, I think, some kind of talking thing happening, and then it's all going to be resulting in an official video reveal for their recent new System of a Down song, Genocidal Humanoids. That should be interesting. You can go and see that if you like. What's definitely really good, and we can vouch for this, is the new four-part mini documentary about Wardruna. What a band. Elle, tell me about this documentary that's going on.
Oh, well, they've released it in like four little bits over the last couple of months, and it's shot really nicely. It's like Ina Selvik, the mastermind behind Wardruna, walking through nature, and there's lots of cutaway shots of trees and snow, and he just talks about some of the themes on the record, which we discussed last podcast, about how... some of the things is dipping into like the oral traditions of singing and how nature can be quite healing for us. And it's just cool. It's just a cool kind of interesting thing.
I've seen a few of those, and they're beautifully put together. I would also like to add that once you're done with those four parts, check back on YouTube, and because it follows a documentary that I made actually with Phil Wallace, who's shot this thing amazingly. We did it back in our old Team Rock days for the London by North event, and it's a history of Wardruna. It's a history of enslaved, and a history of the project that they did together. So go and watch Alex Milas's amazing documentary. And if you're intrigued anymore, go back and check that. It's on, if you do search for Team Rock and Buy Norse as two words, it'll turn up very easily. And it's one of my favourite things I've ever done.
Excellent plug, sir. We're all about Wadrina. We reviewed the new album, I think, was it last week, Al, that we did that, or the week before?
Yeah.
It's out now, isn't it?
It's out now.
Yeah, so the latest Wadrina album's out now. It's really, really good. And we've got a big feature with the bands coming up in an upcoming issue of Metal Hammer as well. Speaking of documentaries, I mean, it's this weird one because this whole situation sucks, but also it's good to see the way the kind of metal community is coming together in light of all this stuff that's going on with venues and bars in the rock scene kind of facing real trouble. So first up, we've got a brand new documentary that's just been released now celebrating the iconic and much missed Crowbar, which was forced to close its doors last year in light of the pandemic. And the owners made a very impassioned speech online about the effects that the pandemic has had on them and the kind of lack of government support that that side of the industry is facing right now. So they put together a documentary called Music When the Lights Go Out. It's on YouTube now. It's directed by Lucy Brown and Andrew Wildey. And it's really, really good. It's a really nice little tribute and kind of a little bit of an inside look at one of the UK's very, very greatest metal bars. Anyone that's spent any time in London as a metalhead will know what the Crowbar is all about. And you can go and check that out right now. And you can also donate to their crowdfunding page, which is at crowdfunder.co.uk/crowbar. And on a similar note as well, another London venue. I appreciate these things are sounding a little London-centric. If anyone on the Metal Hammer Reader Facebook page knows of other venues around the country that are experiencing similar problems that we can shine a light on and help raise support and money for, do post in there and let us know and we'll talk about it here on the podcast. But another great London venue, the Black Heart, is also in some real trouble and they've launched a crowdfunding campaign for survival of their own. They've announced that they've got zero help from the government or their landlords and they really need our support to keep on going. Again, if you're a metalhead and you've been around the Camden area, you'll know what the Black Heart is. It's one of the best bars in London. It's an English institution. And, you know, after losing bars like Big Red and the Intrepid Fox and various others in London over the years, and I know there's many more around the country as well that have been facing trouble in the last 10 years or so, we really need to support these kind of places. They're a vital part of the economy. They're a vital part of the music scene. And anything anybody can do to help spread the message or donate to the cause, I know is much appreciated. So if you want to donate to the crowdfunder for the Black Heart, you can go to www.crowdfunder.co.uk/SaveTheBlackHeart. So this is a tough time that venues and especially bars as well seem to be facing at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I've had some of my favourite bars disappear. There's one in Bergen called The Garage, and it was for, you know, things to do with landlords and it just, it really tears the heart out of the community. And it's just, you know, you have your favourite bars where it's just so much of your life is connected to those and the people and the whole kind of ambience of the place and the people who work there. And I have that with the Black Heart. It's my fate. And I've had that, you know, in a long time with the Crowbar too. You know, I spent, you know, so many amazing nights in there, met so many amazing people. It's so much part of my sort of mindset and you know, it's been part of my life. I just can't imagine life without them, to be honest.
Yeah. It's, sorry, Jonathan, I thought you'd finished.
No. And the thing is as well, it's like, I just want to say that it's part of something that's been going on, you know, a lot, even before the pandemic, of issues of like, especially bars in Soho having been closed down and, you know, wanting to put things up, you know, I think it's mainly so people can put up rents and get new businesses in there. But, you know, it's that thing they say about us critics. It's like, you know, the price of everything and the value of nothing. But, you know, these things are absolutely invaluable.
There was something, was it in the film? I think the bar owner, Richard, was talking about how there were people that come to the bar that now feel like they've just lost a load of friends because they would go in the bar and they'd see people and they'd chat with them and they'd become mates, but they'd never kind of swap phone numbers or been to each other's houses. They just knew each other by first name, and how he himself was talking about being in Soho for so many years and the network of people that he'd made around there, and just that kind of loss, not just of a bar, it's of a community. And I think he's hoping with the crowdfunding, if it's successful, he said in the video he wants to have a bar with a room that can be used as a music venue as well, which would be awesome because it's just bringing that community together again and making a good space for live music when in central London now there just aren't as many spaces. And again, I know Merlin said perhaps this conversation is a bit London centric, so please, yeah, send us your send us any links to anything that's going on in the rest of the country, and so we can give them a shout out as well.
Yeah. Definitely do. We need these bars, and it's like, I'll tell you right now, any city without a metal bar in it is a city I do not want to visit. So we need to support these bars and these venues. And these are two very specific examples, but I'm sure there's
many more. But every bar has its unique atmosphere, and it's just, you know, if you lose those, it's like you're losing colours from the world. Your perception just narrows, and thing is, you know, it would be it's avoidable, and that's a really frustrating thing as well too.
Definitely. But anyway, it feels like a lot of negativity, but there's a lot of stuff to be positive about in metal right now. There are some banging albums coming out this week, and we're going to review a couple of them right here on the podcast. First of all, we're going to talk about the brand new Tribulation album, Where the Gloom Becomes Sound, out this Friday on Century Media. This is a band who are getting, it seems like, more and more hype as the years go on. They're a Swedish quartet whose first album arrived way back in 2009. So they're not kind of a new band by any means. They've been around for more than a decade now. But I guess it's kind of in the preceding years since in the succeeding years since, where we've seen them really kind of evolve and get more hyped up, because they basically started in the death metal scene, and that's where their roots kind of lie, and that's what their early music kind of mainly tapped into. And then as they've gone on, they've kind of evolved into this dramatic gothic heavy metal band. I feel like Children of the Night from 2015 was a real breakthrough moment for them in that respect, and they've got a lot of big tours since then. They've toured with bands like, I saw them with like Arch Enemy. I've seen them, they played with Ghost, obviously, in arenas recently. They've even toured with Five Finger Death Punch in arenas, I think over in Russia or something strange.
Stadium in Russia with Five Finger Death Punch, because they want to play.
It's bizarre, isn't it? Like that pairing just doesn't seem to make sense. But yeah, they just keep kind of getting bigger, and there's more and more hype surrounding this band. They had another album in 2018 called Down Below that did pretty well. And now this is their fifth album, I guess? Fifth record. So this next album is called Where the Doom Becomes Sound. So it sees them obviously at a very important point in their career. They're a band with real kind of underground breakthrough potential. A lot of people are earmarking them as the next band to make a really big step out of the underground and into the kind of mainstream metal consciousness. But there's quite a big caveat to all that, because one of their most recognized members, one of their big driving creating forces, guitarist Jonathan Holton, actually left the band just before this album came out.
No.
Elle is doing a big sad about this. Only was he the guitarist, obviously he contributed a huge amount to the music, but he was also a big visual focal point. If you've ever seen Tribulation live, you'll see him as this kind of like wispy, ghosty figure haunting the side of the stage as he like shreds on the guitar. So he's a big personality, and he is on this album, but he's not going to be a part of the band from this point on. They've already got a longtime friend of the band called Joseph Thull taking over on guitars. So it puts this album in a bit of a weird light in many ways, because it's a hugely important album in terms of their progress, but it also represents the end of an era. So what do we think of this? What do you think of this, Jonathan? You've been on the Tribulation train for many years now.
I remember them back in their death metal days, and you could actually hear some of the gothic elements coming in the Formulas of Death. That was out 2013, and then they came out with The Children of the Night, and I was so in love with this album. Just the atmosphere it had was so incredible, and it has this really like small g gothic feel. It's not like I am goth rock, but it has this kind of it's like this sense of like has a real kind of sense of discovery, like you're just about to enter into this kind of wonderful, strange land. And strangely, like, you know, I guess because it's Swedish, you know, not that strange, because they were probably in connection with bands like Watain, but they also had a similar feel where there was, you know, whatever it was at the heart, whether it's a rock song or it's a black metal song, there was this weird, baleful atmosphere on the out, just hanging around it, that is really tantalizing. And so the music like really draws you in. And I thought Down Below wasn't as good. I thought they'd stripped it down and they'd lost some of their sense of awe of the Children of the Night. And I can really feel it coming back into Where the Gloom Becomes Sound. And you know, has everything you kind of want from a Tribulation record, but you know, at the heart, they're great rock songs as well. And yeah, it's going to be weird without Jonathan, because it wasn't just Jonathan. It was the like, I love bands when you watch them on stage and you've got the front man, but you have this really good communication between the guitarists on either side. And so between him and Adam Zars, there were kind of these two waifs on either side that worked so well visually as a pairing, as well as like on a, you know, as a musical level. So I'd be curious to see how the visual dynamic develops between them. And I'm not so worried about where they're going to go musically. I think they've got, you know, the riffs are so good, they've got that built into them. And sometimes change can be good. And I think I'm really curious to see where they're going what they're going to do musically after this. But this is a really, you know, it's a really powerful record with a sense. Yeah, and I said, you know, they have a sense of awe at the heart of them, and it's an awe that of something that's kind of not quite specified. But I love that kind of open endedness that they have, as well as having like really great.
That's you know, very riffs. Finely put. I love this album as well. I kind of agree. Like, as I said, you've been on the Tribulation train for much longer than I have, but I did kind of come in a little bit on Children of the Night, and that's when I first saw them a couple of times. And I don't know, with Down Below, it's like, yeah, I guess you agree. They just kind of dialed it back a lot. And it's almost like, I almost kind of forgot that album happens, really. It's just kind of like, it was just the next thing they did. Whereas I just think this album's got a lot more about it. And I find it really, it's interesting to me how much people do lean on the goth thing with this band. Like you said, they're like goth with a small G. And like, to me, this is just a fucking great heavy metal record. And yes, it's melodramatic and there's all these kind of atmospheric gothic elements to it. But there are many kind of things in here that are relevant to, you know, King Diamond as there are to anything from the more gothic side of the scene. And I just think the potential.
Yeah, when I said gothic, I meant definitely.
But it feels like that whole gothic thing has kind of formed quite a big part of their kind of personality, I guess, and their the way people talk about them. But I just think they're a fucking great heavy metal band. I'm going to let Elle talk now as well, because I can just hear a single tear rolling down her cheek as she thinks about Jonathan not being in the band anymore.
No, because I have not been on the Tribulation train for long. I boarded the Tribulation train, I'm going to keep going with this, when they supported Ghost, was it? At the
Wembley.
Big place where gigs happen.
We were standing next to each other. Yeah, we were standing next to each other. So I remember like Eleanor's Wonder in real, I experienced Eleanor's Wonder in real time.
Yeah, and I was going to Jonathan like, who's that guy? Who's that guy on the stage? He's amazing. And Jonathan's like, that's Jonathan Hulton. And I was like, wow, he's so cool. Look at the way he's like dancing around the stage and all of his gothic ripped clothes. And he was like a real personality and a real focal point. And I'd never really been that fussed before. And then I really got into them from seeing them. And you know, that's why it's amazing they've done these massive gigs like Wembley, and they played the Russian Stadium with Five Finger Death Punch, because I feel like they're the kind of band where you might not really give them too much of a second look, or you might think, oh, maybe it's too underground for me or whatever, and then you actually see them and you go, they are for me after all. This is just my experience. But Jonathan was kind of being, yeah, sort of a bit like a commentator for me, kind of explaining about different records and the different songs, and it was really cool. So I was really excited when this record was announced, and I really love this album as well. I think it's amazing, and I'm just a bit gutted that Jonathan's leaving, because he's the primary songwriter on this, and I think it's so good. And now I'm not going to get to see him do his crazy stage antics again. Although I would say that his solo record is really, really good. That was out last year, called Chance for Another Place. So, you know, that's what he's going to pursue. So I'm sure there'll be more of that to come.
Yeah, I've seen him live solo. Unfortunately, he lost his voice. It was at Roadburn, but he looked absolutely incredible. And
yeah, he does loads of crazy makeup and dark clothing, and he takes a lot from like silent movies and German expressionist films and things. He's very concerned with aesthetics. So if you look him up, you'll see cool.
Am I right in thinking that when he did the solo album, we didn't actually know that he was going to leave Tribulation? It was kind of marketed as like, this is just what he's doing on the side.
Yeah, very much so. And I think the band, it sounds like the band kind of sensed something was coming as he was getting kind of pulled in two directions almost, and that they kind of knew it might happen, and then he told them that he was going to leave to focus on his solo work. So, but yeah, that all happened enough. Before enough.
But yeah, go on.
One thing also I really love about, I love bands that can kind of straddle different worlds. So they're a bit like Primordial in the sense, in that, you know, they can play, like I've seen them play with
I was at that game.
So they can play, you know, yeah. Underground bands can still dig them, but they appeal to other audiences too. But also, even if you're like a big underground fan, you still love a big anthem, and when it's done right and with the right approach. And so I love these bands. In the same way, when I was a kid, I used to love pop music that was kind of half pop, half kind of avant-garde, but it would be on top of the pops. And I love this kind of, we might talk about this later on actually, but I love this kind of dialogue between different worlds. And when people take things from a very different world and put it into different context, and when you get the best of both, it's incredible.
Leviathan's a really good song on this record. I think that's probably like the most accessible one. There's a bit in the middle, and I said to Jonathan, oh, it really reminds me of like a cross between a Machine Head riff and a spoken word bit from an Architect song, or a sampled bit from an Architect song. And you were like, what, in Tribulation? And I was like, this is just my observations.
Yeah, I kind of forgotten about that, because that endears them in
the original. They've got so much going for them. Do you think that they actually have the potential to follow, like, it's really hard to draw comparisons in extreme metal, isn't it? But you know, I guess kind of Behemoth are kind of the standards comparison at the moment for bands that have come from the extreme metal scene and then broken through into something, you know, significantly bigger. I mean, is there the potential for them to do that? Because I feel like they've kind of been at that precipice for a few years now, although that was before I knew that they were out here playing stadiums with Five Finger Death Punch, of course.
It's obviously really hard to judge the moment without gigs, but the thing you kind of have to go to is when you have seen them live, you know, the level of intensity of the fans, and when they played with Girls Vert, it was like there was a lot of people there to see them.
Definitely.
And it was like their band, and you don't really grow, and you can tell when like bands are going to be big, because they have that baseline of like, sometimes it's beyond baseline, beyond what is kind of you'd expect with some other bands, and the level of passion people had I remember seeing at the gig towards them, even though they were the support band,
definitely.
Was really intense. And so that's kind of what I go on for, you know,
to be honest, band coming out the underground. As much as I think, you know, Gar's interesting and everything, I don't think I would have gone to that gig if it wasn't for Tribulation. And did Idle Hands and someone else really good play that gig, didn't they?
Yeah.
What Iwata, that was the other band. Yes, it was a really strong bill. And Tribulation were definitely the thing that I came back thinking about the most that night.
And it's funny because they all had like an 80s element. I mean, less so Iwata, but all the other bands, they all had an 80s element to them. Like, Eleanor, what are Idle Hands called now?
Unto Others.
Unto Others. Yeah, they had to change their name. But they had this weird mix of like goth rock and new wave of British heavy metal. And it fuses so perfectly that you can't really tell one between the other. And they write great anthems too. And there's a really big buzz about that band as well. But, you know, so there is a kind of like an 80s goth and an 80s post-punk thing that's been really going through the underground. And each in their own way. But Tribulation, I think, you know, after, I think it all kicked off with Climax by Beast Milk. But, you know, there was a different side of the 80s. But I think Tribulation have become the stand, almost like the standard bearers for this kind of gothic sensibility that's been really making its way through the underground.
I would go as far to say that I think there aren't many people who like metal in any sense that I wouldn't show this album to and say, give this a go, because it ticks so many boxes. It's so well crafted. As you guys have said, it's like it's anthemic, but it's also still kind of slightly subversive. And it's just fucking awesome. I love this record. Strongly suggest everyone goes to pick it up. What year are we in? Go listen to it and then buy a physical copy if you really like it. Tribulation, Where the Gloom Becomes Sound, is out on Friday with Century Media. Are you going to add something to that, Jonathan?
Yeah, I think what really comes across is that, you know, it's mixing different things, but it's one single intent. There's nothing calculated about it. And you hear a lot of modern bands, and I feel there's something that, you know, they're just can't, sometimes at the worst, you know, you feel like they're going through checklists of stuff. But there's a real purity of intent, and it's like they're obviously working through their obsessions. And there's a lot of stuff behind the music and a lot of knowledge. Folklore and about stuff to do with Indian tantric rituals. So there's a lot to dig into, as well as it being just superficially a great rock.
Absolutely,
record.
All the best bands have tantrics. That level of depth, don't they? And they're one of them. Also out this week, stacked week for great new music, is the Accept album out as well? By the way, I just suddenly thought that might be out this week as well. You know.
That record, whenever it's out, is absolutely killer.
I think
just sometimes
I
you
think
just want...
it might be out this week. We're not going to do the full review, but basically, speaking of heavy metal, if you just like fucking great heavy fucking metal,
it was
produced amazingly by the one and only Andy Sneap, and just, you know, made to sound as good as that part of the scene can sound. The new Accept album's out this Friday. You should listen to that as well.
Yeah, it has that revelatory feel that only proper old school metal can have.
Are you sure? I think it's been pushed back. I think it's out tomorrow. It's not out yet.
But yeah, it's just if you love
Accept Too Mean to Die, also out. We're not going to review that because if you haven't, you know, if you don't know what Accept are about by now, then where have you been? But if you don't, go listen to it. What we are going to talk about is I think this is the debut album. Am I right? It's not. Oh, okay. So this is, but
no,
still
it's not.
I am wrong.
You're wrong.
My research proved me wrong. But this is, anyway, the new album by a young band, one of the most interesting young bands around at the moment. They're a band called Divide and Dissolve. This is a band made up of two Australian women, Takia Reed and Sylvie Nahill. Sorry if I butchered those names. They're both of Indigenous descent, and they basically crafted this really rich atmospheric blend of tribalistic drone, avant-garde experimentalism to create what's probably going to go down as one of the most unique albums of this year, I think. They're effectively using their music, which is mostly instrumental, as a rally against oppression, white supremacy, the ongoing effects of colonialism. I know they've collaborated with poets and visual artists and other creators as well. So the band that's really doing some world building to get this message across. I'm personally not about that drone life, but I really like this album a lot. I think it's very affecting musically. And I'm especially interested in what opportunities it might bring them to kind of continue to push their message. Because as I mentioned, it's instrumental, or predominantly instrumental drone. So you're not kind of able to dig into the lyrics that are behind their messages and the the themes that they're kind of exploring here. But it's very powerful stuff, and I've not heard a lot of stuff out there that sounds exactly like this. What did you make of this Divide and Dissolve album, Jonathan?
I love the record. So first time I heard it, I think you're right, like it's really affecting, but in ways you can't really put your finger on. So the first time I played it, I didn't actually read the press release that came with it properly, so I had no idea what it was about, which is an interesting way to listen to a record like such as this. And yeah, I found it like kind of deeply sad, a little bit hopeful. It kind of felt like an elegy in the way that, I don't know if you know Godspeed You Black Emperor, where it feels like a kind of, like almost like a road movie through this kind of ruined landscape, and it's an elegy for what you've lost. And it's got this kind of string refrain that goes all the way through it that feels like, yeah, it feels like a kind of an aftermath, and it's really affecting. And it coming out when it did, you know, in this kind of, when we feel like we've lost so much, or there's so much we may lose, it really felt like it resonated with this moment, in the way that, like back in the late 90s, you know, so the end of the millennium, there were a couple of records. For me, it was OK Computer, and a record by a band called Skullflower called Third Gatekeeper. That really felt like this kind of this decaying signal from another age, and this is its last flag. And so I find it really affecting. Specificity of what their music is about, there's something really deeply mysterious about it as well that just draws you into it over and over again. And so, you know, then you go back and I guess, you know, the interviews are part of how the band present themselves as well as the music, so maybe you could take more things. But I think it's with a lot of bands, they might explain what they're about to some extent, but there's something else, like an extra multi-dimensional layer you get from actually listening to the music that they like. And so they're different experiences, but they kind of combine into one thing. And there's also lots of theories about drone and noise as this kind of very liberating, hierarchy-destroying form of music. So it does kind of tie in a little bit. And yeah, so it has to affect you on a really personal level, and then, you know, that kind of draws you into the message that they're giving. And also there's this kind of semi-spoken word, the spoken word part in the middle by a poet, and it's kind of the voice is kind of semi-roboticized, and it's genuinely one of the most moving, saddest, most beautiful things I've heard, even though it's like a kind of a semi-robot voice. And it's like, I don't know, it's like some kind of sci-fi society where it's talking about the age that was before, and it's just bottomlessly poignant and it's beautiful.
Oh God, I don't know if I can add to that. That was very succinctly and wonderfully put, and it's a really good point about how it's a strange dynamic where you could kind of say, well, you wouldn't know what their message is about unless you happen to read their interviews. But then I kind of think that, you know, like you said, there are many bands out there where you kind of really need to get a wider idea of what they're all about to be fully affected by them. And I think once you do kind of know, you know, what their message is and what it is they're rallying against, it does add an extra sense of poignancy, because it is undoubtedly very primally powerful music that they're making. What did you think of these guys, Al?
Yeah, it's not really like my genre. And I'd heard a few tracks online because we had the piece in the magazine about them, and I'd kind of read that and listened to them a bit online. And I was like, yeah, this is kind of interesting. But I think hearing the full record is a much more arresting experience because of the flow of the tracks, because the music ebbs and flows. It's very dramatic and takes you on a journey. And that song that you mentioned, Jonathan, I think that's track 3. Did you have something to do with it? And I found that really arresting, because before I was just thinking kind of, I was a bit confused about this whole how do you get the message across when it's instrumental music, and that literally made me stop in my tracks. I was like, I had it on in one room and was in another room, and I came back and paused it and went back to the beginning and turned it up and was like, wow. And I think the more of that kind of stuff you hear and the more you listen to it, the more you are dragged into its world. And then when you find out more about them through their interviews and you think about what they're actually doing, it becomes a more powerful whole. So I think to me, I was a bit kind of like, yeah, you know, whatever, it's all right. But having sat with it longer and thought about it more, I feel like I've kind of digested it in a way that I hadn't earlier. And, you know, they're obviously trying to do something very powerful that is powerful when you hear it and is also powerful in terms of what it's trying to do, like highlight white supremacy. And, you know, they sort of talk about protecting black futures, and you know, there's obviously a lot more going on the more you dig in at the surface, and the more you listen, the more you feel what they're trying to do. So it's not something that you can casually listen to or have a passing interest in, really. You have to kind of stop and actually take it in.
Because it's not a polemic, you know. The thing that's so powerful about it is it's so open-ended and mysterious at the same time. Like I said, I get that with Godspeed You Black Emperor as well. And, you know, and you know, that's another band where, it's real, like, the whole band is very much comes from a way of life, like the way they live, you know, as a kind of a commune. And so it creates this kind of fully immersive, you know, so it does kind of create this kind of very fully immersive world. And I guess it's more about as much about the dynamic of fighting this thing, fighting these, you know, oppression, as much as it is just making one kind of particular case. You know, so there's so many levels and layers to it. You know, otherwise I could just put out a polemic and say this and that, and that'd be the end of it. But it just, you know, I had a visceral effect to the music before I even knew what they were about.
Yeah, I think that's what it's all about, really. It's just the fascinating duality that's at the heart of this band, and whether you choose to engage with their message and their fight, I certainly hope people will. It's, you know, it's vitally important that we celebrate bands that are unafraid to confront these issues. But yeah, musically as well, Gaslit is an amazing album and very powerful. Yeah, very powerful album title as well. It is out this Friday as well via Invada Records. That's Divide and Dissolve with Gaslit. They've also got that great Tribulation album. And if you just want some no-nonsense heavy fucking metal, do go listen to the new Accept album as well. They're all really, really good. 2021 definitely off to a flyer in musical respects, at least. Let's do some reader questions, shall we? How about you take this first one, Elle?
Sure. This is from Andrew Brown. He says, this is going to be a good one. What's better, metal covers of pop songs or pop covers of metal songs? Evidence for each. So we have to give our examples as well. Do we like metal covers of pop songs or pop covers of metal songs?
I can't think of a ton of infamous pop covers of metal songs, to be honest. That's where I kind of came unstuck quite quickly.
I can think of one.
Go on.
I would prefer pop covers of metal songs rather than metal covers of pop songs, just because metal covers of pop songs, for the most part, aren't really going to bring out something new out of the original, other than make it a bit more gruff and a bit silly. But
some are really amazing.
Yeah, there are. The exception, the main exception being, of course, is 2SS doing Rasputin, which is amazing. I am. I saw 2SS's first gig in London in front of 50 people, and I knew then and there that they were going to be huge. And I'm not normally into this kind of silliness, but I love 2SS. They've got something that I love them, and I love Trollfest and certain bits of Fintrol as well too, where it's just, it's very knowing. But that, but you know, it just hits all your pleasure centers. That cover version. However, like hearing Tori Amos doing Raining Blood is pretty amazing experience. And also, you know, hearing her version of Smells Like Teen Spirit too, not a record song, but and it's not really pop in the normal way of things, but it certainly puts something into a whole new light and context, and you know, makes Raining Blood kind of poignant. It's like, I'm not quite sure what she's trying to say in that, but lots of different things, but I feel them all, and so I kind of really love them, love that version. I prefer her cover of Smells Like Teen Spirit, because it really brings the sadness that's at the heart of that song out. And so that's a song that puts a metal song in a completely different context and really brings something else out of it. I can't think really what else
I mean, obviously Manson's cover of Sweet Dreams is a good example of
actually that is a great song. That is great. All Manson covers are great.
I'm sure there's others out there. I can't think of many that come instantly to mind.
Nuclear Blonde.
Can I do my favourites? These are my favourite metal covers of pop songs. I like Disturbed and Land of Confusion again, by Genesis.
Add kind of complex emotional layers like Tori Amos does.
I think I like it because I just found it like fun, and I didn't know the original when I heard it, so I just didn't really know what they're doing, and I just kind of like it now. Limp Bizkit's Faith. Yeah,
again, kind of like, amazing cover, but definitely kind of annihilated what little subtlety there was in that song.
Yeah,
gives me screams.
I love that cover, Behind Blue Eyes.
I don't like that. That can get in.
I disagree.
I'm taking it out of the bin.
It's coming back out of the bin.
No, two people want it in the bin, and one person wants it in
this
the bin.
This ain't a fucking democracy, my friend. It's coming out the bin. No,
don't you pull
I like that song.
Us.
I think it's underrated. And, I'm sticking up. We're holding this podcast dead. I'm sticking up for that Biscuit cover. Not only is it good, and not only does Fred do a perfectly reasonable job of singing that song, but the little robo voice thing in the middle is really good. It's a really good addition.
Oh God, it's so. It's the thing is, like, it's all the self-pityingness that he ever used to exhibit, all distilled down, you know, with extra kind of self-justification. And it just makes it into really self-pitying, horrible,
I think, schmaltzy. It's a good cover. And you know what? A lot of people agree with me because it's their second most streamed song ever. So there. More streams than Take a Look Around.
Wow.
Or Breaks Down. Yep. Yep.
What? Is that just people by accident searching for it and then not realising it's Limp Bizkit and then turning it off because it's bad and they actually wanted to listen to the Who?
Well, give
when you're saying the Who, we're talking about the British band, not the
yeah.
HU.
Speaking of cool covers, anyway, sorry, Al was mid flow. Yeah. Go on.
I've not finished my answer. Here's one. I know those two that I said, Disturbed and Limp Bizkit. They're very new metal covers, and I like them. But you know, Jonathan mentions that covers can be a bit silly, and perhaps they are a bit silly, and that's fine. But one which is really good is the whole Deftones covers album is amazing. And they do The Chauffeur by Duran Duran, and that's really good.
Yeah, I think some...
Anybody going to react to me? No.
I like some covers albums. Between the Buried and Me did a covers album. And that was kind of really interesting. Like what they chose, and they were kind of fairly obscure songs actually, but it told you a lot about the band. So like covers albums usually have a different point than sticking a bonus track on at the end of something. Like, you know, a covers album is going to tell you a lot about where a band's coming from, but just doing you know, a cover of Britney Spears isn't necessarily going to do that.
Yeah, well, the Deftones one, it obviously tells you all their tastes and things. You know, they've got Sade and the Cardigans, Lynyrd Skynyrd, Japan, Duran Duran.
Japan is one of my favourite all-time bands. I need to go back and listen to what do you know? Do you remember offhand what Japan song they covered?
Ghosts.
That's like Japan, Olama, Alpha and My Amigos. Too long a story to tell you here, but I'm only doing what I'm doing because of Japan, but that's a long story.
Well, then aren't you glad we had this conversation and I started talking about metal songs?
Yeah, Ghosts is the second strangest song to have ever been a huge hit. It was number 5 in the charts, and it's the second strangest hit in the world after Oh Superman by Laurie Anderson. And it's all based around this minimalist composer called Erik Satie, musically. And it's one that, again, these are both two amazingly beautiful, poignant songs that are really avant-garde. And Ghost was number 5, and Oh Superman by Laurie Anderson was number 2 in the charts. And if you listen to Oh Superman and you watch the video, it's on YouTube, and I just remember to have some stuff. I grew up in a world where this is number 2 and in the charts. And for anyone else, like, it must be a completely alien world. But I'm really glad I grew up in that alien world where, like, really avant-garde
fair
stuff is
huge. Enough. I'm just trying to think of anything else bit I could add in, really. I mean, yeah, obviously the Johnny Cash cover of her, it's not metal either way, but definitely.
No, the original's better. I hate it when people say the Johnny
Cash. Well, I didn't say that, did I?
They can get it in the bin as well.
I actually prefer the Johnny Cash version, but it's a good example of two songs being so different. Same with Sweet Dreams, really. The two songs are so different that they completely stand in their own totally separate entities to me. Like, listening to those two songs, the two versions of her, inspire very different emotions in me personally. So,
oh, yeah. I mean, some of my favourite songs are like cover versions of songs. And there's a Swans version where they cover Cry Me a River. It was called Skin, which is basically the main two people from Swans. And it's the most, you know, Cry Me the River is just this kind of like, it's sad, but it's a kind of very, it's sort of in the easy listening vein. And you hear like Jarbo from Swans singing Cry Me a River. And it's genuinely one of the most haunting.
You're talking about Cry Me a River by Justin Timberlake?
No, by Julie. No. The late 60s.
Oh, please tell me you thought you meant Justin Timberlake song as well. Thank goodness.
I thought you meant Justin Timberlake.
No.
And I was very confused. I was like, why would they be doing that?
Julie London. It was the Julie London version, which is, they just happen to have the same song title. See, I'm a generation where if you say Cry Me a River, I'll immediately think
I'm disappointed
London,
now. I thought there was a Swans cover of Justin Timberlake out there that I hadn't heard.
No. The original Julie London one is a great song, but the Swans version or the Jarbo version is one of the most haunting things you'll ever hear and will put a chill into your bones that you won't get out.
Why are you always trying to make us listen to horrible stuff, Jonathan?
It's not. It's incredible. It's one of the most powerful things I've ever heard. So I love cover versions where they completely transform a song and put it into that band's own world. But metal bands don't often do that. Having said that, there's an amazing, and as much as I like Neil Young, I think most of the Neil Young covers are better than the originals, like Cinnamon Girl by Type O Negative.
Oh, yeah.
And also Steve Von Till from Neurosis. He has a Neil Young cover which is just so incredible, and I prefer that to Running Free, I think it's called. Not Running Free, that's something else completely. But it's just incredible.
All right, cool. Let's move on from the covers. We've got a lot more questions to do. Matt Heeks says, you can go see any band once everything is back to normal. Do you go for a band that will put on an amazing all-round show like Rammstein or Tool? Those are two very different visual bands. Or do you go for a smaller band to go wild to and have a party to? I mean, I've seen Elle watch Rammstein. Elle has a party to Rammstein and Tool. So you shouldn't have both.
It's exactly what I was going to say. And I think I mentioned I've got tickets for Rammstein and it's meant to be in June and, you know, not sure that will happen. So at some point, though, I would like to use my Rammstein ticket to go and see Rammstein and I would have that a lovely party. That would be a
party indeed. What about you, Jonathan?
Definitely the latter. I miss my crew. I miss my gig crew. I miss the kind of going to an underground gig and knowing so many people and just, I need that sense of community back again. A gig at the Black Heart, a gig at the Dome for me, or, you know, being a Londoner, but I need to be in a room where, like, you just have to get eye contact with someone and you're all feeling the same way and becomes bigger than some of its parts. So I need a sweaty gig, and I miss
same, my crew really bad. Feeling that. Tony Glover says, "What are your best and worst?" I didn't see that it said best. I've just been thinking of worst. What are your best and worst music purchases, albums, gigs, merch, etc.? We'll try and keep this relatively streamlined. Best. What's your best music-based purchases, Jonathan?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know what this means. I mean, it's like some records I bought when I knew what they sounded like, but other records, you know, back in the days before internet, you know, I'd buy them on a hunch or I'd buy them, you know, from a review. So probably for me, like, let's just to continue this conversation. I'm going to say the first Japan record I ever bought, because that set me off on a long path that's got me to where I am today. It was I can't remember the name of the song now, but probably Japan. I've bought records on spec that have blown my mind. You know, when it comes to metal, I've kind of known what I was going to buy beforehand. So I'm going to talk about my pre-metal days.
The irony of you saying talk, and I'm talking. He does say albums, gigs, and merch. So it doesn't have to be albums. It could be a gig ticket you bought or a t-shirt you got or
something. Okay. Well, okay. So this would have been about 86, 87. And I was obsessed with a band called Throne Muses, and I also toured with Pixies. And Pixies were headlining. And I went, as soon as I heard there were tickets, I just ran straight to what's now the Forum, used to be called the Town and Country Club, and I bought a ticket and I had ticket number 0001. So that was really happy with. Merch, box sets, usually it's box sets. I have some amazing box sets that I bought. I always buy Watain box sets when they come out. I've got the Coven box set, which is a thing of absolute beauty. I'm kind of obsessed with box sets, really. And certain bands, the minute there's a box set, I'll buy it. And having Lawless Darkness as a box set, having the whole run of like Coven albums on gatefold vinyl, just gives me huge.
Excellent answers, sir. Eleanor, what about you? Sorry, Ellie. Go on, Ellie.
Today. My worst is an album that I bought because of a review in Kerrang. And like you said, Jonathan, it was sort of pre things being on the internet. And I was obviously well into new metal and it got a good review. And it was Pin the Tail on the Honky by Dislocated Styles. And it came out in 2001. And it's terrible. I think there was one good song in it, like the first single, that I enjoyed, and then the rest of it is like absolutely dire, and that's from somebody who loved new metal so much, so you know it's bad. And then my best, I think probably gig tickets I bought to gigs out of the country, because I got to see the band and go and have a holiday as well. So I went to see Isan at the Moulin Rouge in Paris with a big group of friends, and that was really fun because we just messed around in Paris for a couple of nights. And I went to see Tool in Berlin, and it was their first European show on the new record. And again, it was pretty much the same group of mates, and we just went and went to all the rock bars in Berlin. So not only did we get the gigs, we just got to have a load of fun as well. So obviously a bit more expensive than buying Pin the Tail on the Honky, but infinitely better, I would say.
I have one more to add to that in that case. I went to Berlin to see Church with a very good friend of mine.
That's awesome. Yeah, I was going to say, actually, I've got, I fucking love churches. I think we've actually talked about churches on this podcast before, which is a bit weird, but they are amazing. Yeah, I mean, any special gig ticket, definitely. I mean, tickets for, I went to see Metallica in Prague in 2019, and that was really special because I was there with my mates, and it was just the kind of thing that seems a million miles away right now, but that was very special to me. In the theme of kind of like music that got us going, I'd have to say my cassette copy of Rolling by Limp Bizkit, because it was the thing that got me into metal. So definitely shout out that. That'd probably be worth money now, I imagine. Is there currency for that kind of thing? Maybe not. I don't know. I don't know what Bizkit nostalgia is a thing or not. And then, yeah, I just got a few things. I mean, I think T-shirts from gigs that end up holding a very special place for you or kind of were an event. So, like, my Maiden Twickenham T-shirt is probably my favourite piece of merch because it's so unique. It's Eddie with the rugby ball. It probably remains my favourite gig ever. And it's just anytime I wear that T-shirt out anywhere, someone will go, oh, my God, what T-shirt is that? Or where's that from? Or, oh, my God, you got the you know, I didn't get a T-shirt for that gig that day. So that's really special to me. Also, the Metallica S&M T-shirt that I got when I saw them do S&M 2 in San Francisco. I can't remember if I've mentioned that on here before. it's a really cool, like, boot, kind of pretend bootleg one, if that makes sense. So it says San Francisco in the Metallica font on it. on the front with the Jump in the Fire demon hanging over the Golden Gate Bridge. So it looks like a fake T-shirt, but it's an official one. And it says San Francisco, so it like doubled up as a momentum. And I'd probably also say my Prodigy tattoo, because I got that the day after Keith Flint died, and it was my first tattoo I'd got. And me and my good friend got kind of matching ones. And I'd never got a tattoo before, and it kind of sort of fed into this emotional situation, but also a very wholesome and unique experience that was, you know, my first tattoo, and so it means a lot to a variety.
I have tattoos that said my first two tattoos were like band related, and especially the second one, which is Death Spell Amiga from Chain of the Catechin EP, done in Bergen, one of my favorite places. And the record means a huge lot to me. The people who did it mean a huge lot to me. The place where it was done means a huge amount to me. And yeah,
awesome. So, that's cool. And then I've just got random ones. Like, I had a pair of Iron Maiden Vans that I loved, which is not quite as deep. But I also want to say as well, I got the not a metal one at all, but my favorite vinyl purchase of all time. When I finally started properly collecting vinyl, I held off on buying a copy of my favorite hip hop album of all time, which is Stankonia by Outkast, because I knew that the 20th anniversary was on the way, and I was kind of just holding my nerve a bit to see if someone would release a 20th anniversary version of it. And I said to my mate for like a couple of years, like, I want a special edition of it when it comes out. And lo and behold, the brilliant Vinyl Me Please released a version of Stankonia that was on like smoky vinyl, and it came in a really nice cardboard sleeve set, and it is gorgeous. And it's by far the happiest I've ever been opening up a vinyl set in my life. So that is up there as well. In terms of worst purchases, probably just all the crap nu metal albums I bought back in the day. Like Elle said, I had the Drowning Pool records. I had the Union Underground record. That's probably still in my CD collection somewhere. It's not though.
Yeah,
is it?
That's a good one.
It's terrible. There's got like two all right songs on it. Yes. What other tunes do they have, Elle?
Exactly. Me Mr. Dead Man.
So yeah. No, nothing else going on there. So yeah, fuck that. What an idiot. Right, let's pick another question. Let's do one more. This one's kind of related to our current cover run of The Who, High Lung, Twin Temple, Alien Weaponry, Unique Young Bands. Alistair Belling has picked up on the fact that at least three of those bands you can't really call heavy metal bands, which is quite interesting. Maybe that's a bit harsh on The Who, but certainly in the case of High Lung and Twin Temple. So Alistair Bennett's kind of caught up on this, and he says, it's a two-pronged question. What do you think it is about acts like The Who and High Lung that makes them so taken in by the heavy music community? And from that, what do you think describes heavy in a 2021 context? Elle, I'm going to let you answer the first part of that question, and Jonathan, you can ask the second part. Go on, Elle.
Yes.
Okay, so what do you think it is about acts like The Who and Hyland that makes them so taken in by the heavy music community? I think it's just the sense that there's more at work in the music than what you hear on the surface, and that there's more... there's like a deeper cultural significance to their work and perhaps darker themes. And I think that's what kind of takes them outside of the mainstream and makes them accepted by the heavy metal community. I think also there's an indescribable energy about some bands as well, connected to those kind of feelings of reflecting culture and exploring sort of the darker parts of the human condition. There's just kind of this energy in heavy music that goes beyond that surface level and kind of pulls you in and attracts you. And I think it's kind of hard to articulate what I mean by that, but I think you could just kind of feel it. That's what I'm going to go with.
Yeah, I'm going to add something to that. Yeah, because I think, you know, heavy metal as well, is it's predicated so much on the sense of continuity. Like, you don't have this in a lot of other sort of popular genres where, like, you know, everyone is aware of where it started. And there's so much dialogue with the origins. And, you know, bands like The Who and Heilung and Vardruna, and also other bands like Dead Can Dance, which I don't know a single black metal fan who does not love Dead Can Dance. You know, they have also that sense of continuity as well, too, culturally, physically. And I think there's a real bonding between that as well. And you know, there's a lot of, especially from an underground metal point of view, there's a lot of things that we would never call them metal, but every metal fan I know loves, like Woven Hand, Dead Can Dance, Fields of Nephilim, where, you know, what you know, if let's say if you're into black metal, you're not, like I said, it's always been more than just about the music. It's been about the sensibility and a certain kind of spirituality. So even though, like, Woven Hand is like a hardcore Christian band, the more you're into black metal, the more you like to get that band, because it's you feel a kind of a spiritual resonance in how it's approached and the absolute conviction with what it's done. So you don't have to call it metal to sort of find an affinity with it, but you definitely find an affinity with it on a very spiritual level. And yeah, and you know, there's other bands as well. Like, another band that means a lot to a lot of black metal fans I know is a band called Bowen and the Club of Gore, which is this weird, really slow late night jazz that's kind of almost like it's slower than your body rhythms. And so it just draws you into like a different kind of level of consciousness. And everyone I know is obsessed with that band. They'll go and see their gigs. They find it like an absolute spiritual experience. If you have that, if you go to a Fields of Nephilim gig, you'll have that. I'm lucky that I'm old enough I got to see Dead Can Dance back in the day at their height. And yeah, there's something really, it gives you like a sense of this higher forms of consciousness. And I think that's what, you know, I relate to as like an underground metal fan.
What is the name of the band you just mentioned, beginning with B?
Bohren. So it's Bohren and Der, Club of Gore. And last time they played was
Jonathan. Not heard of them before.
Yeah, they've been around for a long time. And like, I know so many extreme metal fans who are just absolutely obsessed. And when they've seen, I've never had the pleasure to see them live, but there's this one album I used to play and I used to go to sleep to it, because like I said, it drags your body rhythms down to a different level. And it just slows time down, so it changed your level of awareness. I used to cover them in my old magazine, Terrorizer, actually, and it's heavy in the sense of atmosphere, but heavy means different things, and they don't necessarily mean the same thing, and they don't necessarily have to equate. But I think, yeah, the heaviness of the atmosphere is how I describe that heavy. In that sense, so I don't think you have to call things metal in order to appreciate them as a metal fan. I just think we find correspondences across very different forms of music.
Definitely. And I think, you know, it made me laugh because Danny Levers, one of our great writers, wrote a really good piece on how much of the heaviness in, much of the best stuff coming out of the metal scene right now isn't metal at all. And what was really funny is that there are a few reactions on our Facebook. You know the types. And people were going, well, most of the bands in this list aren't even metal. And it's like, yeah, like that's the point. And I think people who kind of try to rally against this thing, like, oh, it's not metal enough, it's not proper metal. It's like, it really doesn't fucking matter. Like, if you go to the gigs, it's predominantly metalheads. It is what it is. Well, accept it.
Yeah. I mean, the question you have to ask yourself is like, do you like this band for some of the reasons that you like some of your favorite bands? Like, is there like a parallel or is there a dialogue between the two? Like, I might like a lot of pop music, but I don't like it for the same reasons I like metal. I like it for wholly different reasons. But the things that draw me into, say, Watain or Deathspell Amiga are, you know, the things that are coming from that draw me towards that are the things that are coming for me that would draw me towards Bowen and the Club of Gore or Dead Can Dance or Woven Hand. So things I like from a completely different sensibility. And I will never, you know, like, I just don't see how Poppy fits into our world in any way, shape or form. That's me personally.
Because, you know, she wears quartz paint and does her name in a logo and stuff.
Yeah, but, you know, when we did that thing for the census, when we said, like, choosing metal as a religion, what you're saying is that metal is as much a sensibility as a riff. And so, you can play a metal riff that doesn't necessarily, in my mind, that doesn't really make you necessarily a metal band in any way that's meaningful to me. But a band like Dead Can Dance or a band like Woven Hand are meaningful to me in the way that being a metalhead is meaningful to me. And I actually put metal as my religion on that, because I felt I got so much more of my values from entering the metal world than I did from whatever religion I had. Even though I'm informed by what religion I had as well too. But I just felt like that was the most, but putting metal as religion for me was like my most meaningful thing, because that's where I got so many of my values from. And I find those values in things outside of metal as well too. And, you know, I found them in things that I listened to before metal that draw me into the metal world, where I found a correspondence between Dead Can Dance and, you know, certain black metal bands, for instance. So it's a two-way thing, but it's how those things have meaning for you in that same sphere that you like metal.
And just to add very quickly as well, that whole thing we were talking about you missing community and missing gigs, and you know, it's common to sort of compare that to a religious ceremony in some senses, because there's this enjoyed shared sense of enjoyment and worship element of the music in the way that you experience it. And so when you're talking about metal as a religion, I definitely think you have to bring live into it as well. And perhaps with some of these bands we're calling heavy, it's as much about the live experience as well as the recorded experience and how that can make you feel as well, which could be very
hard to agree on all of this, although course, with the caveat that, as we have established recently, it doesn't mean you have to be friends with racists just because they like metal. I think that's just about it for this week, everybody. Thanks for joining us very much. As I say, sorry that I sound like, as El put it earlier, I'm thrashing around in a bin.
I don't know what you're talking about.
That's okay. You can be in the bin
fuck it. Happy. Me and Fred Durst in a bin. That's a sitcom. It's fine. Two men in a bin.
Two men in the bin.
All right, let's leave it there. Thanks, everyone. You've got one more week to pick up the latest issue of Metal Hammer in UK shops, which means that next week we will be unveiling our very special, very emotional new issue that I think a lot of you will appreciate very much. And we look forward to showing you that. In the meantime, stay safe out there and keep looking after yourselves and stay metal in that. Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye. Bye-bye.